Welcome once again, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast, live from our wonderful new podcast room here at the Baseball America World Headquarters. I'm John Manuel. He's Matt Eddy. Matt, welcome back, and we're apparently your podcast playoff prognosticators, as we did the first round, and I don't know which one of us got more right. I know I did pick the Cubs, but I don't believe – I think we both picked the Phillies, or did we not?
I did poorly. I think I picked all the losers.
Good grief. Well, the Angels were a good pick. I thought the Angels were a good pick. I thought that the first round was less competitive and less – apparently less competitive and also apparently less compelling than I think we'd hoped. TV ratings weren't very good. I do think we have two excellent championship series. They're both best of seven series. You only have two instead of four to try to focus on. I think these are going to be more compelling series, and I hope for the industry and for the sport that the ratings go up as well, because that seems to matter. But we'll start off talking in the National League. It's a historic matchup, a matchup with some precedent, and they have had three previous Dodger-Phillies matchups. Obviously, Jamie Moyer would have been the only player who could have possibly played at any of those, and even he didn't play. Even he hasn't been around that long. 25 years ago, 1983, the last time these two teams matched up in the National League Championship Series. But Phillies-Dodgers, for someone of my age, that does seem like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. That's happened before, and I'm not surprised it's happening again. And Matt, the Dodgers certainly seem to be kind of the flavor du jour, just because of the way they dismantled the Cubs. But I think there are other things, Manny Ramirez factor, the Joe Torre factor. Why do you think they were just so dominant against the Cubs? Was it all the Cubs, or do you think that the Dodgers had as much, if not more, to do with it?
Well, I think the whole series kind of hinged on game, the game winning bat by James Loney, where Dempster got him to 0-2.
Right.
And then Loney barely fouled a pitch off and he hit a grand slam on the next pitch.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, from that point on, the Cubs were never in it. It was
no,
just.
They weren't
but
in
I,
it.
But I think deeper than that, it was just the pitching. They never gave the Cubs a chance. They just had all these right handed arms to throw at the Cubs' right handed army of batters, you know? And then.
That was it. The Cubs never made an adjustment in the entire series, whether it was any of their hitters, any of their pitchers. They never made any adjustments. And the Dodgers certainly have some youth, but now they have these twin guys with all this playoff experience, three or four players. We were talking about Jeff Kent, who didn't really play much in that series. But you got Manny. You have Joe Torre as a manager with all that experience. You have Derek Lowe. And those guys, Derek Lowe was outstanding in Game 1. Ryan Dempster is a veteran who has been in the playoffs before, I believe, but not in that role of being the guy. And Derek Lowe was very cool and calm under pressure, and Ryan Dempster was shaky. And then Chad Billingsley was playing with house money, and Chad Billingsley is just really, really good. And he was outstanding in Game 2, and then the Dodgers – able to bring it home. Impressive that the Dodgers able to get some playoff victories without Jose Lima on the mound. First time since 1988 that they've been able to do that when it was not Lima time. But the Dodgers, and you mentioned it, the Phillies present a different challenge for Dodger pitching because clearly they have more prominent left-handed bats. You're not talking about Kosuke Fukudome and Jim Edmonds. You're talking about Ryan Howard. You're talking about Chase Utley. Do you think the Phillies are a tougher matchup for the Dodgers, even though they're not as good as the Cubs really were during the course of the regular season?
No doubt about it. The right-handers' changeups are in play now. I would love to see the number of changeups thrown by Dodgers pitchers in that series.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just taking that pitch. It's just, I don't know.
Now you're taking that pitch. You're right. That pitch was not in, really had to be, didn't have to be in play for the Dodgers. They really could pitch off power and Derek Lowe's strictly off his two-seamer and his sinker.
Yep.
And they're going to have to come up with, I think, a little bit more of a wrinkle against especially a guy like Chase Utley. The other thing about the Phillies, you talk about the left-handed bats, Matt Stairs, Jeff Jenkins, Greg Dobbs, pinch hitter deluxe.
Yep.
Charlie Manuel has options on his bench go to for pinch hitters, whether it's for the pitcher or elsewhere. And then you have Victorino, a switch hitter, obviously in the lineup as well. Just matching them up offense for offense. I know the Phillies were very inconsistent this year. There were some stretches where they really did not score runs in bunches, and part of that, I think, had to do with Chase Utley's slump after that huge start he got off to. He did have a long stretch of the season where he just wasn't as good, but I think the Phillies are the better offensive club here. Do you think that's true despite the presence of Manny Ramirez with the Dodgers?
I do think it's true, especially when you can you can pitch to Ethier and Loney with left-handed relievers, and that's another strength of the Phillies: left-handed bats and left-handed pitching.
Good point. And the Dodgers make a move to combat that on their roster for the championship series with Takashi Saito, who's been banged up, their former closer. Did not pitch well against the Cubs either when in his one appearance, and now he's off the roster and replaced by Hong Chi Kuo, the power Taiwanese left-hander. So it gives, I think, a smart move by Joe Torre, Ned Colletti, the brain trust there in Los Angeles, to give them an extra lefty reliever and not put all of it on Joe Bimel.
Yeah, because it sounds like Kershaw's going to be used in a starting role, and Maddox will be used in the long relief role. So that seeing Kershaw in the NLCS against Ryan Howard and Chase Utley, that's going to be one of the highlights of the series.
Absolutely. Well, it's the Baseball America podcast. Matt Eddy and John Manuel here with you. And I guess another part of this series that's so intriguing to us is just the prospects become big leaguers that both teams have. I mean, the Phillies, I don't think it's a coincidence that they've had their back-to-back playoff seasons. Was this for the first time ever in Phillies history, or first time since 76, 77,
I think it is? First time since the 70s,
That they have back-to-back playoff seasons. I just don't think it's a coincidence that their ace is Cole Hamels. Their number two starter all year was basically Jamie Moyer, but right now it's Brett Myers. Mm-hmm. And those are two first-round picks for 99 and 2002 for the Phillies. And then you've got Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, real homegrown flavor, Pat Burrell, obviously, to their lineup as well. And the Dodgers, this is, you know, half vagabonds, half their 2005 Jacksonville Suns team, it seems like, with Billingsley, Broxton, Russ Martin, James Loney, Hong Chi Kuo was
Matt
on that
Kemp.
Team. Matt Kemp was on that team toward the end of the year. We're just missing Ching Lung Hu, Tanislav Abreu, and Andy LaRoche. Since traded Andy LaRoche, and you've got our 2005 minor league team of the year. So, but I guess the perception, where I'm going with the question, Matt, is that the perception is the Dodgers are the more homegrown team. To me, the Phillies are just as homegrown. We didn't even mention J.A. Happ. That's a team that Homestar would love. Homestar Runner would love this team. They're very homegrown. Oh, sorry, I had to go there for that reference. But I think the Phillies are a little undersold on that, don't you?
I do. I think you are correct in your assessment. Ryan Madsen.
I didn't even think about
him. You know, I guess he's in the kind of the eighth inning role now after flaming out as a starter and being good and being bad and being good, you know. I think he's picked the body he wants to go with at this point.
I think you're right. If only Kyle Kendrick will do this in the future. If he could follow the Ryan Madsen approach. He's picked the body and he's sticking with it. He's a middle reliever with a great changeup.
Yes.
Which is going to come and play again with those left-handed Dodger bats.
A very funky long arm action, too, I think, which helps him quite a bit.
He is funky. And I guess the other key here is not a homegrown player, but we mentioned it in our division series preview, the Brad Lidge factor. Brad Lidge down the stretch was not as good the last week or so of the season. He was shaky in the first game of the series against the Brewers. If Brad Lidge is on his game, though, I think Philadelphia gets the advantage in the bullpen. I guess to me you got the hitting is an advantage Phillies. Starting pitching, I think clearly the Dodgers had the advantage in starting pitching. Bench, that's almost a push. The Dodgers carrying a lot of extra infielders who don't have a whole lot of offensive value. Jeff Kent's kind of like the wild card on their bench. For me, if he's in the lineup, I don't like their bench as much with Blake DeWitt. I don't see Blake DeWitt as a rookie being a guy who can come in cold off the bench and be as good as maybe a Jeff Kent, who maybe would be able to prepare better, come off the bench and be effective. I think I get the Phillies a little edge off the bench with those left-handed pinch hitters.
Yeah, going out and getting Matt Stairs at the end of the year, a great example of that.
And then bullpen, who gets the bullpen itch for you? I mean, the Phillies have been better all year, but the Dodgers' bullpen is pretty good. Corey Wade is a very undersold prospect. He's been a very solid sinker ball reliever for them.
Yep.
I think I'd have to give Philadelphia a slight edge, but bullpen is certainly not a weakness for the Dodgers.
Yeah, that's really a toss-up. Maybe Broxton is just as good as Lidge. He just hasn't proven it.
Right.
You know, he's closed out every game of the DS.
You're right.
And obviously he's got the stuff to do it. I guess you read in some cases that he can't stop the bleeding in some cases. When he does have a bad inning, it snowballs on him.
Great. That's a great point. He's a guy that you like to bring in to start an inning, not necessarily into the breach in the middle of an inning with guys on base.
You know, and what if a newly healthy Rafael Furcal makes an error? You know,
right.
What if Matt Kemp misplays the ball in center field? You know, is this gonna crush Broxton's ability to get the next batter out.
Absolutely, just to be able to concentrate and refocus. And Brad Lidge, he's probably never going to go through a lower low than that bomb hit by Albert Pujols off him, and he's shown that he can come back from that. Maybe it took him a year, but he's shown he can come back from that. So I'm picking the Phillies. They were my pick in the National League to start the postseason. I mean, the biggest obstacle in their path, it's easy to say, is Manny Ramirez. He's an incredible postseason hitter. When he gets locked in, he cannot be gotten out. I think Charlie Manuel hinted at what their strategy is going to be when he said, joked, that you can't walk him 28 times. They're going to walk him every time it matters. They're going to make the Loneys and the Ethiers and the other guys beat him. And if those guys beat him and they beat all their left-handed relievers, if they beat J.C. Romero, if they beat J.A. Happ out of the bullpen or Scott Ayer, the Phillies are going to tip their cap and play for next year. But I think the Phillies will be good enough to beat the Dodgers if they don't let Manny beat them.
So you can take it to the bank that the Phillies will win because I'm picking the Dodgers here.
That's right.
I just think the team is a little more complete.
I think they are a little bit more balanced, and I do think the Dodgers, bottom line, the Dodgers have better starting pitching.
You know, is Manny going to be disciplined to lay off everything out of the zone they're going to throw him? Probably, yes, he will. He'll probably just take the walk.
You're right. And if they're young hitters, I would bank on hitting those left-handers. Ethier and Loney are two pretty good guys I think I would bank on. But true. I think that's going to be a great series. If it goes fewer than six games, I'll be surprised. It's the Baseball America podcast. I'm John Manuel. I'm joined by Matt Eddy. Let's move on to the American League, Matt, where you have two franchises that couldn't be more different in a lot of ways. The Red Sox are clearly the bully of this decade. They're the only team that's won two World Series championships this decade. They're the most successful franchise in this decade, and they're the defending World Series champions with a giant payroll. And meanwhile, they're the Rays, and they're second up from the bottom in the World Series. I mean, second from the bottom second from the bottom in payroll. And yet, they won the American League East fair and square. They beat Boston 10 out of 18 meetings home head to head, and the Rays have the all important home field advantage, which they won by going to Fenway in September and winning 2 out of 3 from Boston. So I got a feeling that the national media expects the Red Sox to be the favorite here, but I almost feel like this is as push of a series as you can get because head-to-head, they did play 18 times, and the Rays were slightly better, even when they weren't at full strength.
Yeah, and they'll be presenting just their best 20 players, let's say, you know.
Yeah.
That's always the thing. You know, another, you mentioned how different these franchises are, but in one area that they're very similar is that each organization's top three players was homegrown.
Yeah.
When you look at the Red Sox, I mean, you can't argue. It's Youkilis, Pedroia, and John Lester.
Yeah, right now, absolutely.
The three best players for this series.
Absolutely.
And then for the Rays, it's Shields, Longoria, and Upton.
Yeah, oh, no doubt.
I mean, this is, I think that's a great way to...
It's a great way to enter into it because, I mean, B.J. Upton's a guy who had a struggling regular season but was dynamic against the White Sox. I mean, the Rays are a great example of a team that Josh Boyd, now works for the Rangers, used to work here, talked about the scouts they talked to. He said, back when the whole scouting versus sabermetrics, quote-unquote, debate was going on, the scouts would tell him, you know, tools win championships. Well, this team is loaded with toolsy players, and B.J. Upton, in my mind, is the toolsiest of the toolsy players, and a guy whose power was significantly down this year. His slugging percentage was down more than 100 points, and yet he unleashed that raw power against the White Sox, and when he gets into one, it's just pretty. It's just so pretty to watch.
And Longoria doesn't have the run, but he's got everything else, man.
Holy cow, he's got everything else. He makes the power look so easy. The defense looks so easy. And then James Shields, I heard Elliot Johnson on a local radio station today, a Durham Bulls player and a longtime Rays farmhand, call him Big Game James. And that's, you know, the Rays. You would imagine with Boston that Josh Beckett or Dice K, the guys with all the money, would have been their number one starter. But clearly, like you said, John Lester is clearly their ace right now. Beckett said it at the end of the last series with the Angels. And as good as Scott Kazmir is, he's not their ace. It is James Shields. The other thing that strikes me as a commonality between these two teams, actually, Matt, is their defensive efficiency.
Hmm.
I mean, that's a huge step forward for the Rays this year to previous seasons. You hear some talk about Jason Bartlett almost like being their MVP in some ways. What's your take on that, number one? And which team do you think is the better defensive team out of these two, if you had to pick one?
Well, if I had to pick one, I would probably pick Tampa Bay because they're younger and they did it on turf.
Yeah,
I would assume that would give them the advantage. You know, Bartlett's MVP candidacy on his team, you'd probably ask the pitching staff. This is not a strikeout-oriented pitching staff, especially outside of Balfour in the bullpen. You know, Bradford relies on those ground balls being converted into outs. You know,
that's a huge point that I had not thought of.
Garza's strikeout rate is significantly lower than it was in the minor leagues.
That's correct. And Jackson and Sonnenstein are basically guys who Sonnenstein's a ground ball guy, and Jackson, even though he's got power stuff, is not a strikeout pitcher. I know he's not pitching, but just over the course of the season,
right.
I think you make a great point. Shields is with the changeup, but they've got to, they have to have batted balls turned into outs with efficiency to win, to make the leap they did this year. And especially out of the bullpen, like you said, they really didn't have, outside of Balfour, a guy who goes out there and just blows you away. I mean, J.P. Howell, a guy who is really a guy who has to gets the ground balls, change up, 88-mile-an-hour fastball. I mean,
and max effort breaking ball where he falls off the mound.
and he's been outstanding this year, which is just it's stunning that he's taken so well to that middle relief role. And there's really not a weak link on this team defensively that I can think of.
You know, the only question would be Carl Crawford coming back from the injury, but I'm sure that didn't affect his legs as long as he was on a running program.
Right. I do think Boston's defense, while it's good, and it's very good, I think if Mike Lowell were healthy, you could. I think you'd almost have to call it a push. But I do think as good Kevin Youkilis certainly can play third base, and he plays it well. He's not as good as Mike Lowell. And while Mark Kotze showed in the game four the other day against the Angels how good he can be at first base, he's inexperienced over there. So I think Boston's not quite at full strength when you look at it defensively if they had Youkilis at first and Lowell at third. We'll see if that affects them. But you mentioned it. You're throwing in the additional factor of the turf, where Youkilis only played 30-plus games at third base this year. I wonder how many of those were on this field turf surface, which is only really employed in Toronto, Minnesota, Tampa, that I can think of. So that's an extra factor, I think. And I think you're right. And just in general, the Rays have a little bit better team speed, and that should play on the turf where they're four of the seven games are scheduled.
Though when the Red Sox do have Crisp and Ellsbury out there, that's probably the best 1-2 off-field combo.
It is. I mean, they're better defenders than Crawford and Upton. Crawford and Upton are faster, but that's a better combo defensively with Crisp and Ellsbury with their versatility and just their more experience.
But that's the other thing that Crawford coming back spares the Rays fans from is Eric Hinsky in left field.
But you do have Eric Hinsky is like the one. He's the one guy with a World Series ring, I think, on this team since Percival's not on the postseason roster. Let's talk about the starting pitching of these two clubs. Starting pitching was certainly a strength, if not the strength, for the Rays this year. All five of their starters won between 11 and 14 games. Edwin Jackson doesn't make the playoff roster. He's the only one who was basically average or below this year, or below average, I should say. But their top three, Shields, Garza, Kazmir, versus the Red Sox top three, Beckett, Matsuzaka, Lester. Who could see edge there with Beckett the way he is right now?
Well, Kazmir the way he is, too.
That's the flip side of it. I think Boston has to be given a slight edge there. Just the postseason experience that they have with Beckett, if he's at his best, which obviously clearly he's not, but even when you're not at your best, I think that's where you almost draw and experience more. And John Lester, what are the 22 scoreless innings in the postseason right now consecutively? And Daisuke Matsuzaka, who has plenty of big game experience prior to the Red Sox, but has been through this grind now last year. I guess I'm wondering about the freshness of the Rays pitchers. All three Red Sox pitchers, but especially Daisuke and Beckett, have been through long major league season and postseason grind before. The Rays haven't. To me, that gives Boston an edge. What do you think of that?
I think that's fair. And one of the more interesting matchups is going to be Daisuke against this lineup.
Yeah,
he will not give in to batters. Will the Rays wait him out? You know, will they be capable of doing that? I think that'll tell us a lot about how ready they are to win this series.
And you know, it seemed like it was like the immovable object and the irresistible force when he played the Angels, when he pitched against the Angels, but he couldn't hold with the bullpen's help. Daisuke couldn't hold a 5-2 lead in that series. And, you know, again, was not pitch efficient. He's a five-inning guy, which is why I'm a little bit surprised he's the game one starter. To me, the whole key for Boston is Beckett. Mm-hmm. That's oversimplifying things a little bit, but like you said, you got Beckett and you got Kazmir, these two Texas fireballers, two Texas prep products. There's a nice parallel there. And before this year, Scott Kazmir, it seemed like he was always at his best against the Boston Red Sox.
Right.
It was a kind of a Red Sox killer throughout his career. This year, not so much. You know, I guess if you had to pick one to pitch well in the postseason, in this series, Beckett or Kazmir, I think I almost like Kazmir's stuff was better against Chicago, I thought, than Beckett's stuff was against the Angels. I thought that Kazmir was closer to what he really is than Josh Beckett was. I don't know if that gives an advantage to Tampa or not.
I think that's fair. You know, but then you don't really want to bet against Beckett's extensive playoff record.
His playoff resume is unmatched right now among active big league starters. So.
I mean, that's John Smoltz or Andy Pettit like if he had been given that number of starts, which he probably will. He's with Boston for one more year.
I was about to say, yeah, he's on his way there for sure. To me, the biggest advantage Tampa has going into this really is their bullpen. And you mentioned one of the key factors, Grant Balfour. We've talked about J.P. Howell. Dan Wheeler almost like is the symbolic, the guy who kind of started the tide turning when they traded one of our personal cheese balls, Ty Wigginton, to acquire Wheeler from UNC Asheville, baby. He's, I believe, the second player ever out of the Coastal Plain League to make it to the major leagues, which is for some reason a little factoid drilled into my brain. But to me, the real X factor here, we talked about the left-right matchups in the NL series, and Matt, you pointed this out to me. The Rays are carrying three lefty relievers, Trevor Miller, J.P. Howell, joined by David Price. Can you imagine the scene if David Price is called upon in a key situation to get one of Boston's big lefty bats out, J.D. Drew, or Big Poppy Dave Ortiz? How fun will that be to watch?
It'll be awesome. It'll be Kershaw-esque. And
that's right.
And it looks like the way that the Red Sox are constructed, they're not going to have a right-handed bat to bring in. So, I mean, you can, if you're the Rays, you can bring in a lefty reliever with impunity.
Right, because Boston's carrying both Casey and Kotze as their extra.
And Alex Cora is a lefty batter.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, their righty bat is as the roster is presently constructed is Gil Velasquez
or the backup catcher.
And that's the thing. Again, that's where they miss out not having Mike Lowell.
Right.
At the very least, you have Coco Crisp possibly off the bench if he's not in the lineup, and he's better from the right side. So Boston really, I think it's a deft move by Joe Maddon and company with Tampa to carry that extra lefty. I do have a feeling that if push comes to shove, it will not be David Price with the game on the line against Big Poppy in that situation. But you got to have somebody for that situation. The Yankees have not had that shutdown lefty out of the bullpen, and it has been to their detriment in the postseason.
Trevor Miller's the guy here because Howell's a one inning at a time.
Or two innings.
So his ratio to games to innings is pretty high.
And then you have Boston's bullpen, which is the other to me. Which is really their weakness, and that's not new. That has been Boston's weakness in previous postseasons. We're talking about 2003 or 2005 to a lesser extent. You know, they got their bullpen. It was even kind of a weakness in 04 in some ways before Keith Foulke. In front of Keith Foulke, they were still a little shaky. But right now, Boston's really going with Papelbon, Masterson, and maybe Del Carmen, but they clearly trust Masterson more than they trust any of the other middle relievers. This is a guy with 88 career minor league innings. And while he's a sinker baller and a big guy who has a low slot and some sink, he's given up 10 home runs in 88 big league innings. Do you think Boston's bullpen, it's clearly not as good as Tampa. Do you think it's good enough for them to win this series, or do you think that's a thing that keeps them from repeating as World Series champions?
I think it's good enough to compete against this particular team.
Maybe
another AL giant or might be able to combat them, but I think they're fine.
I actually think the Rays probably have the weakest offense of the four remaining teams. Right. I think I would take Philly and even LA's offense with Manny in there, and especially Furcal. He's kind of an X factor. You don't really know what we're going to get out of Rafael Furcal, but yeah, go ahead.
Maybe against the Rangers in Arlington. Maybe I wouldn't feel confident with this group of pitchers.
Yeah, I wouldn't feel confident with any group of pitchers in there, right? And maybe right now, but they've been probably a little bit rusty down in Texas.
But you know, in like the whole Daisuke thing against this lineup, are they going to show more patience than the Angels did? Are they going to wait out? And are they going to punish the Red Sox pitchers for making mistakes? You know, the Angels didn't do that.
Now that is really the question. And you know, Mandel Carmen throws a lot of strikes in the regular season. Will he throw enough strikes in the postseason? You know, which Hideki Okajima is going to show up? At times, he's been the same guy he was last year, but for the most part, he hasn't been. So, we mentioned Mandel Carmen. I think maybe it's a good place to finish is to talk about how each of these teams, Matt, we'll explore this a little bit more at BaseballAmerica.com. But each of these teams really do have a player or two, if not more, who kind of wandered through the prospect wilderness for a while before finally breaking through. And Manny Del Carmen is a great example of that for Boston. I mean, this is a 26-year-old who really only in the last 2 years has finally established himself as a full-time big leaguer. And, wow, I mean, there's a Boston native who's not just established himself as a big leaguer, but as a good big leaguer the last 2 years. You know, who are some of the other guys on some of the other clubs? Del Carmen's kind of the guy who stands out for Boston.
He does.
Who are some of the guys on the other clubs who kind of fit that description a little bit?
For Tampa Bay, we're kind of looking at Gabe Gross, their most of the time right fielder, who admittedly doesn't hit lefties very well. But he was Gord Ashe's last first-round pick with the Blue Jays back in
01. In 01, yep.
Like 14th overall from Auburn. He's a guy who's cemented himself pretty well with Tampa Bay this year after getting 1 year to prove himself in Milwaukee, and they didn't go back to him last year. But
right, yeah, they really and that's the thing in Milwaukee. He really, I mean, he was kind of a platoon player, sort of not. I mean, here when you're a first round pick and an outfielder, just like corner guy, you're picked because of your power. This is, you know, the first year he's hit double digit home runs. You know, he still only slugged 414, but he had some key hits. This is really one of the years where he finally got some consistent playing time and finally made something of it coming over. And Ben Zobrist kind of fits that same category as well, as a guy who, I don't know about wandering in the prospect wilderness, but kind of always a little, I don't even say underrated, just never thought of as a guy who's going to be an impact guy, maybe an extra guy. The guy hit 12 home runs this year. Mm-hmm. The Rays had a lot of injuries this year, and yet, despite those, they really got, you know, they got a big year, as J.J. Cooper would say, a dead cat bounce year under Eric Hinsky. Had really not been good for several years, but for this year kind of showed some bounce back.
Yep.
You got Fernando Perez as a factor in this series with his speed. And he's almost like their platoon, almost like right-handed platoon for Gross, and he was not a good right-handed hitter in AAA this year, was he? Or was it from
the left side?
Oh, the right side.
He's a natural right-handed batter.
He strikes out so much from the left side, it's almost like give up that experiment.
And then they also have Baldelli to factor into right field.
Absolutely.
In a platoon situation.
Rocco.
Being such a young team, they have a lot of these candidates. You mentioned Zobrist, but there's also Willie Ibar, who came back from being MIA last year to being a legitimate fill-in for Longoria for a month.
He did a fantastic job while Longoria was hurt, and a guy who obviously was originally signed by the Dodgers, too. So
yeah.
Two straight
seasons. For mucho dinero.
I think it was $1.4 million.
Something like that.
But we'll see if Willie Ibar has more success against the Red Sox than Eric Ibar had. Things are not going so well for Eric.
I think they're stepbrothers, right?
Is it stepbrothers? Kind of like the Asturias brothers. The Asturias brothers are like half-brothers because they're only 7 months apart in birthdays. So that's a little bit scary.
Well, we already talked about J.P. Howell, who formerly was a top prospect for the Royals, who they traded for Joey Gathright.
Yeah, so the Rays get to the big league, get to the postseason without their I forget what year that draft was. I think it was 01. Where Benny Latino was a scout for the Rays at that time. And in the 32nd and 34th rounds, he got them Chad Godin and Joey Gathright. That's pretty good value.
Nice.
That ends up being a pretty good draft. And wrapping up in the National League, the Dodgers have one of the ultimate wilderness guys here in Hongchi Kuo, who, again, mucho dinero. This guy got, I think, $1.6 million out of Taiwan, maybe more than that, as a free agent in 1999.
It's almost a million per Tommy John surgery, isn't it?
He's had at least one, if not two, and, man, it just took him forever. Another member of that 05 Jacksonville team who was just starting to come back there. He's a fastball split lefty. There's just nothing typical about Hongchi Kuo. He's made, you know, he's got 80 innings this year. He's always had a high strikeout rate, but this has not been a guy who's ever been able to stay healthy. I mean, this 80 innings is by far the career high for him.
And he just absolutely manhandles left-handers.
And he was absolutely manhandled last year. I mean, he had man hands last year. 70 ERA. So you just know Hongchi Kuo. I think he's the proverbial box of chocolates. But I do like the Dodgers including him on this roster. And again, to a lesser extent, Blake DeWitt didn't wander through the valley or anything, but he was certainly not given up for dead. But he was given up as a guy to be an impact guy. I don't know how much more of an impact you make than being a regular on a championship caliber team, and that's what he's done this year. He's been a solid average regular.
He's very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, he gives you good at bats.
And kudos to Alan Matthews for sticking with him. He was De Podesta's first round pick, I believe, in 04.
04, yeah. Well, him and Scott Elbert.
And Scott Elbert.
They bookended the state of Missouri with their first round picks, much to Jim Callis' delight. Nobody loves Missouri prospects like Jim Callis. And I never forget watching Blake DeWitt at a fall showcase in Jupiter, a perfect game worldwide bat showcase, sitting there with Bobby Miranda, who was then the assistant coach at Georgia Tech, videotaping DeWitt. and telling me how good his swing was, and I was like, I don't see it. And Bobby's saying, well, here's what you're not seeing. There's this, the balance, how quiet he was, efficient swing. Bobby was right on that.
Let's also give him credit for learning essentially a new position this year, because he came up as a third baseman, went back to Las Vegas, AAA, and played second base, which he was drafted as, and played, up through 06.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then this year, gets the third base job out of spring training, which was a surprise.
Yep.
But then is asked to go back to second base when injury calls. And, I mean, the guy just has grinded it out, and he's been solid at both positions. I mean, that's all you can ask for from a rookie. He's been a pro. And that's a good worth bringing a note. Nobody wandered through the wilderness like Chris Coast on the Phillies. We almost forgot to mention him. This guy wrote a book about playing an indie ball. He's a J.J. Cooper hero. When they first played at Fenway Park, taking off his cleats and just running barefoot through the grass at Fenway Park, just to the sheer joy of the game that Chris Coast brings is awesome. But Greg Dobbs, a guy who was a fifth-year senior sign, a guy that Pat Gillick brought signed in Seattle and has brought with him to Philadelphia and just become a pinch hitter supreme. And I don't know if he's a personal cheese ball or not, Matt, but I know we both like Jason Worth.
No, definitely Jason Worth. You know, he shed that label of platoon batter this year with authority. I mean, this guy does hit right-handers. Maybe he strikes out a little more against them, but he can put good swings on them. The guy is an excellent defensive outfielder. Would play center field for some teams.
Yep.
Awesome arm, awesome runner.
He's a great example of why athleticism matters at baseball. He is a premium athlete, drafted as a catcher, but his athleticism allows him to improve. It allows him to make adjustments. It allows him that versatility and allowed him as a player where he had weaknesses, clearly he still does, but his athleticism, you couldn't give up on that, and that allowed him to – it basically bought him time to get good enough as a hitter to find his niche as an everyday regular. And the Dodgers, certainly a lot of those guys are familiar with him because he was a Dodger a couple of years back on their last playoff team. So, fun podcast. I'm picking Boston in the American League. We didn't make our prediction. I just think Boston's experience and a little bit better starting pitching is the separator for me.
Yeah, those guys know what it's like to go through a seven-month season, not a six-month one.
That's right. And yet, I believe you're picking Tampa.
Yeah, I'm taking the Rays. Rays versus Dodgers. So,
Rays versus Dodgers would be a fascinating series. I think any of them – I mean, the Rays are a hard story. You'd have to mess up to not market that one. They are a Cinderella story. That said, that ballpark is so hideous. I really don't want to see that ballpark on TV for the World Series. You got that one versus Fenway. That's a no-brainer. I know a lot of people are tired of the Red Sox. I assume you would have quicker games if the Rays were involved. That also would be, I think, to their advantage, to the TV's advantage. I think that Fox is clearly going to be rooting for the Dodgers. It's Los Angeles. But I think the Phillies are a compelling story. Whether it's Charlie Manuel or Ryan Howard or Chase Utley, to me, they're compelling. I don't know if they would suck in the whole country. But a Boston-Philadelphia series would certainly have some cachet. But I think Boston-LA is what the Fox people want.
Would you pitch Brett Myers in Boston?
Oh, I don't know. Can you legally, or do you get arrested? I'm not sure about that one. Yeah, they have long memories there. That'd be a little bit like Canseco with the steroids chant in 88. I don't know what they would chant at Brett Myers, but yeah, I'd forgotten about that ugliness in Brett Myers' past. I think he would. He can also. I think in Boston, he could not make the joke about how they were going to trade Kendrick to Japan for the guy who was the hot dog eating champion. Boston has two Japanese players that might get offended, so we don't want to go there either. But if it were a Boston-Philadelphia series, as I'm predicting, I think that would be a hell of a series. And the Phillies are the kind of team that actually have the depth, or they'd have a DH, and it would be to their advantage in the American League park. And Boston clearly would be at a disadvantage without the DH. I mean, who are they going to sit? I guess with Lowell hurt, they could sit Kotsay and just play Big Poppy at first base as they've done in the past. But Boston seems to be at a little bit of a disadvantage when they're in that situation where I think – I don't know who the Dodgers would DH. Maybe Jeff Kent. But he's not as good as I think the options.
Or Pablo Ozuna.
I think Greg Dobbs is the perfect DH.
Right.
He pinch hits four times in a game. But,
yep. Here's Stairs, no doubt.
Matt Stairs clearly has experience.
Maybe you save Dobbs so he can come in on defense, you know. But either way, they're both good hitters.
Well, if past performance is any judge from these podcasts, you look for a Boston-Philadelphia series, because I think I was more right than you were in the division series. But we'll see. We'll come back next week before the next series and see who was more correct as the Baseball America postseason podcasts roll on. For Matt Eddy, I'm John Manuel, and again, check out that little personal cheese balls thing we're gonna blog at the Baseball America Prospect blog. But for Matt, I'm John. Thanks so much for the download. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.